The Ark of the Covenant. Wouldn't you like to have seen that thing? It was a little, small little box, 3.75 feet by 2.35 feet by 2.25 feet high. Contained, well, let's make it just a trivia question. We're playing Bible trivia. You want to move your little piece around the board. What was inside that box? Three things. Well, the Ten Commandments, written on stone. Yeah, not paper from Home Depot, Office Depot or anything. Ten Commandments, manna, representations of the manna, and one other thing. Aaron's rod that had budded, which is a whole other sermon on the resurrection. Because God, if God can take a piece of wood and make it bud, I know as a former landscaper, that's impossible. And so it's just another testimony to the resurrection and God's power to resurrect you to life. But that's what was in that box. So overlaid with gold. On top of it, it had a lid, had a golden lid. And on top of that lid were two cherubim-class angels. Cherubim-class angels, according to Ezekiel chapter 1, they're like God's secret service. And it's a whole other study of the cherubim class of angels, different than the seraphim class, who are more like the worship leaders, according to Isaiah 6. But the cherubim, that's what Satan was. He was the head of the cherubim class before he fell. And he was the highest order of angel, but he defected, as we all know, and a certain amount of the angels, I think a third of them went with him. But they are there guarding the holiness of God. And you cannot approach God without them knowing that you're coming, based on how they're, what they look like. So they're on top of the lid, a representation of them in gold, because that lid was known as the mercy seat. That's where a sinner could find mercy before the holy God. Huge significance for the nation spiritually, because God said, this is specifically where I am. So when the tent moved around, the tabernacle moved around in the wilderness for 40 years, God had promised, I'm gonna be there specifically. So you can imagine how excited David was in his day and age. He reigned from 1011 BC through 971 BC. They constructed the ark sometime after 1446 BC, probably closer to like 1440 BC. So if you do the math, if you like math, this is close to 475 years it took to get the ark to Jerusalem. That's a long time. 475 years. So David is the king. He's going to move the ark to Jerusalem, the new capital of the new land of promise. And don't you know, this is going to be a festive day. It's going to be an amazing day, because with the presence of the ark in Jerusalem in a temporary tent, because David couldn't build the temple, that was going to be his son Solomon's job, because David is told by God, you have too much blood on your hands as a warrior, but I'm going to give that to your son Solomon. So then David started collecting all the items for building the temple. But to bring that and put into a temporary tent in Jerusalem was a huge thing, because it represented, number one, worship of God is paramount for a nation. And number two, it represented that God was supposed to be central to their thinking. They were to think about him above all things. So when you read 1 Chronicles 15, if you want to read it sometime this afternoon, huge fanfare when they brought the ark to Jerusalem. There were cymbals, chants of joy, trumpet players. There were sacrifices to cover the sins of the people. And I'm sure there was a few Pentecostal dancers in there somewhere. The super excited. The more stilted people like me, thank God, hallelujah. And then the more expressive people running around going, amazing. We have them in our church, do we not? Yes. I don't know where they sit, but they're the ones that are talking to me right now. they're typically closer. The more reserved are in the upper echelons. But anyway, so total excitement. According to 1 Corinthians, Chronicles 16, when they've as they're bringing the ark into Jerusalem proper, David offers even more burnt offerings to cover the sins of the people and peace offerings in that order, because you have to have your sin covered before you can be at peace with God. So he covers the sin of the people. Then he offers peace offerings to say, we now have an intimate relationship with God. How exciting is this? And then he says, hey, by the way, we need to worship God perpetually. So he then appoints the Levites to minister before the Ark of the Covenant perpetually. He wants to make sure worship is constantly going on. And he wants them to guide the worship in front of the Ark of the Covenant. He did one more thing that's absolutely amazing. He's a politician, isn't he? He's a king and he's a soldier, but he's also a musician. And he likes to play what's he play? It's a harp, yeah? And it's like a Stratocaster. It's a harp. One person knows what that is. That's exciting. he plays a harp, and he writes music. In fact, a lot of his songs are recorded in the book of Psalms. If you read Psalms, a lot of them say, the superscription to the psalm says, to David, la David, is what it says in Hebrew. But that's part of the inspired text. In the English text, it's not counted as verse one, but in the Hebrew text, it's verse one, because David wrote that psalm. And so this is the psalm that he wrote for this festive day is found in 1 Chronicles 16. We don't know the tune anymore. You can't play it. Have no idea how to play this one. But we know the words. We have the lyrics. And that's what we're going to analyze, because we are at a festive day, as it were. Are we not? They were waiting 475 years to get the Ark of the Covenant to the capital of the land of promise. And God was faithful to them to make sure it happened. We're looking back at, 50 years of the faithfulness of God. And how should we approach that? Well, this song is going to teach you how to do that. What you're going to learn in David's song that he wrote is that when you express thanksgiving to God, it calls for specific, concerted action on your part. Like what? Well, he's going to tell you like what. Number one, when you want to express thankfulness to God, it involves what David's going to tell us is you need to get to the point where you recall his faithfulness with specificity. It says, then on that day, David first assigned Asaph and his relatives to give thanks to the Lord. So this would be something akin to our worship director is Monica. She does a fine job with our team. This would be tantamount to me saying, hey, Monica, it's our 50th anniversary. You're the director of our worship, and we want to make sure that we always have a family line dedicated to worship at our church. So we're never going to hire anybody outside your family line. Your family line is the family line. So I don't know what your husband's doing for a job. Probably needs to resign and come work at the church. And I know what your kids are doing. I know one's in college. You have one at home. But they need to be thinking about being part of the worship line. And that's what David does. He says, I'm going to take the family of Asaph, and I'm gonna make them like my key worshipers. Verse 12, he tells you as you give thanks to God, here's what you need to do. He says, and it's in bold letters, you need to do what? Remember. It's that Hebrew word we used last week, zakar, to remember with action. Remember, what do you need to remember? Well, he said you need to remember his wonderful deeds, which he has done, speaking of God, his marvels and his judgments. So three things. From his mouth, he says, O seed of Israel, his servant, sons of Jacob, his chosen one. So he first tells you need to remember. Now, the first thing that you notice as you read this, if you read it in the Hebrew text, is there are imperative verbs all throughout this entire song. What does that tell you? Well, grammatically, it tells you it's not a suggestion. You got it? Three got it on the front. I'll say it again. When he tells you to remember, it's like, I don't like to remember. I got a bad memory. I'm not going to do that. No, he said, you need to work at remembering these three things that I'm going to tell you about God to give thanks to him. So it's to remember. It's a command. It's a command. So he says, let me explain to you what you need to remember. So the three things. So what's the first one? Remember his, it depends on your translation. Wonderful deeds is New American Standard. NIV says, remember his wonders. So the Hebrew word pala, which speaks of something that's wonderful, really refers to something that's like off the grid. Like I scientifically can't figure that one out. It defies all known laws of physics. What in the world just happened? It's used in Exodus chapter 3, verse 20, the same word pala, of wonder, of what God did in the 10 plagues. I mean, that's the word used to describe the 10 plagues. Because when, as I told you last week, when God destroyed the Egyptian pantheon of those 10 plagues, he did pala, he did wondrous things that you would know it's the finger of God. In fact, eventually, the sorcerers are going to say that. Because they use witchcraft to try to copy some of those. But then all of a sudden, they throw up their hands and they tell Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. This wonder is only things that God could do. So one of the things I find interesting that God did, and I would like to ask him when I see, I have a lot of questions when I see God, don't you? Yes. I just hope I remember them. I know I can't take my list with me, but I hope I remember my questions. But in Exodus chapter 10, verses 21 to 29, in the middle of those plagues, God sends utter darkness on the Egyptian empire. You know, it's a beautiful day. All of a sudden, there's no sun. There's no stars. It's thick blackness. It's not an eclipse. Something happened that's astronomically impossible. But what's interesting is it just happened over Egypt. Really? And it just happened over Egyptian homes. Serious? Yeah, because it says there, he struck them with darkness, but over the Israelite homes, there was light. Now, it's not like they had Duracell batteries and little things ready for when the power outages came. They didn't have those things back then, right? And no, you know, it's like, no, 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 no. No, what he's telling you is God used selective darkness to cause the Egyptians to wonder, my neighborhood is totally blacked out. I can't even see the sky, but I can see off over in that hill over there in that Israeli sector, it's quite light. How is that possible? That is called a pala, a wonder, a wonder. David said, also remember God's marvels is the other word that he uses. Mofet is the word of a marvel. It's used in Exodus 7 verse 9, where it's translated a miracle. Says in verse 9, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle. He's mocking Moses. Work a miracle. Then you will say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh that it may become a serpent. So he tells you, and I'm just, because some people in our church read Hebrew, in case you're wondering why Hebrew's up there. Or you might even thought, what is that anyway? You might even know it's Hebrew. But that's the word mofet, right there. That's the word for miracle. So he says when David says, remember God's mofet, his miraculous activity. Well, like what? Well, it's used in Exodus 7, 9. When Moses tells his brother Aaron, hey, when I give you the word, take that wooden staff, just throw it down on the ground, and God's going to turn that piece of wood into a hissing, seething snake. You ever seen that happen? No, no, no. How could that happen? Only God. And so he takes that rod and he throws it on the ground before Pharaoh. Now we know that the Egyptian, if you study the context, the Egyptian sorcerers did the same thing. But theirs was different than what Moses did, because if you study sorcery within the Egyptian empire, what they did with snakes was there were a pressure point on the head of the snake. And if you squeeze that head, it could go from rigid to flexible. And that's all they did. What'd God do? He took a piece of wood and turned it into a serpent. Boy, talk about a miracle. So David says, remember those things about God. David also commanded them to remember that God is a God of judgments. The word is mishpat. He's a God of mishpat, or just justice. You could go through the Old Testament all day long and look for the mishpat, or the righteous judgments of God. One that I found that is most interesting, amusing, and ominous all at the same time is in Numbers chapter 16, when a group of little men decided to have a coup d'etat against Moses because they didn't like his leadership and they wanted to usurp his power by getting rid of the old man. Their names, in case you have forgotten them, are Dathan, Abiram, and On, plus 250 other followers who wanted to get rid of Moses because they didn't like him. How'd that go for them? You remember the context? God says, you shall not overthrow my righteously appointed leader, Moses, and because you have challenged him and tried to usurp his authority by coup d'etat, everybody get away from these guys. Why, what's going to happen? Well, I'm from California. I know what happens when an earthquake happens. Sometimes you hear a loud boom off in the distance, and then the ground starts shaking. And I don't know if you've ever been in an earthquake before, but I've been in them where you can hear the rocks crunching underneath your feet in your neighborhood. That is most unsettling. But I've never seen the ground open up and swallow people. Wouldn't that get your attention? How does God feel about coup d'etat and opposing godly leaders? He didn't like it. He said, let me make an illustration of these men by making the ground open up. They're all going to fall into it. Then the ground's going to close. End of problem. We'd be losing a whole lot of people today in our country, wouldn't we, if you're making an application? That's not all that God did. For the 250 followers, he sent fire down from heaven on a perfectly clear day and vaporized them. They were just gone. That is what you would call a judgment of God that was righteous, because God says, if I have chose the leader, i.e. Moses, you do not try to usurp his authority by coup d'etat. And David says, these are the kinds of things that we remember. It says in verse 14 of this passage that we're studying, David throws in these words. He is the Lord, our God. His judgments are in all of the earth. Now, which you read Hebrew from right to left and then up and down, because those little dots and lines are the vowels for the consonants. So when you have the word he, Yahweh, God, our God, when you see it written like that, the he is most emphatic to mean you better stand up and pay attention to this. Who is he? What does he say? He is the Lord, our God. His judgments are in all the earth. Now, what is missing in that sentence when you read it in Hebrew is a verb. Do you speak with no verbs? Maybe when your children disobey you and do something off the hook and you kind of stutter speaking that you use as a parent. This is like speaking with no verbs. Why in the world would you do that? Grammatically, it's called ellipsis, E-L-L-I-P-I-S, ellipsis. They did it on purpose. Why? To make the entire statement emphatic. Who is God? Well, he's the Lord. He's the covenantal God, and he's faithful to his people, and he brings judgment. Where? Well, to the entire planet. And one day, he's going to fulfill that because he's going to bring judgment to the entire planet and then bring the king back, Jesus, and set up his kingdom. That's getting ahead of ourselves. But we know that God judges the planet and steps into human history at times to guide history and deal with people, because we know from a passage like Daniel chapter 4, verses 28 to 33, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the greatest empire on the planet, is walking around his palace one day, and he decides that, look at what I've done. Look at how great I am. Look at how much wealth I have. Look at how many soldiers I have. Look at my armament. Look at the nations I've defeated. I am so awesome. Arrogant and prideful. God heard him. What happened? God said, you're not the most important person on the planet. Let me reduce you. And he struck him with a disease that made him go crazy. And he was like an animal. And they kicked him out of the kingdom. He lost his kingship until he learned. And he did learn that there is no other God but the living God. Kind of like what Xander was talking about. And so God used mishpat, judgment. David says, remember these things. And David's not done. There's another command to remember. Remember his covenant forever. The word which he commanded to his thousands of generations, the covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac, and he confirmed to Jacob, the statute to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, I'm going to give you this land as a portion of your inheritance. They were only few in number, just very few strangers. They wandered about from nation to nation, blah, blah, blah. He said, remember the covenant. What covenant? Well, the Abrahamic covenant, the unconditional covenant that God gave to Abraham when he lived in Ur of the Chaldees. He took a polytheist and made him a monotheist because God revealed himself and he realized my polytheism is erroneous belief system. There is only one true God. And he began to worship that God and he moved his family to Canaan and become the promised land, and God renewed that covenant to him. What was the covenant? That, well, Abraham, you will become a great man. They will always remember your name. You will become a great nation and God will bless the world through you. My wife's great-great-grandfather's name is Abraham, David, Solomon. It's over for me. I told her one time, it's like, okay, I'm married to the greatest king, the wisest king, and you're in the line of Abraham. I mean, I'm a Gentile. I'm glad Jesus grafted me in. You know, I mean, Abraham, what a great name, right? We're still talking about it. It's in the name of Liz's family. And so God says, I struck a covenant and I kept my covenant. And I promised Abraham a land that would bless the world. And what's the devil trying to do with Israel today? Wipe it out. It ain't going to happen. Why? God has his eye on those people. He's going to bring the Messiah back to establish his king and his kingdom. But in David's age, they had been waiting about 1,000 years to get into the land. Because Abraham lived around 1091 BC. David reigned from 1011 BC to 971 BC. So you can kind of be a little flexible with the math. But it was about 1,000 years they're waiting for God to bring the king and the kingdom, and David's getting to see it. And this tells you something about God. I've told you this before, he does not move fast. I might talk fast, but God doesn't move fast. 1,000 years, I got it. And David's like so excited. He said, we need to remember that God is a God who keeps his covenant. When you look at someone like Xander sharing his testimony, a man locked up in a false system of belief that rejected Christ the Messiah, you saw that in that despair and that hopelessness, he came to know the Lord and Savior of his soul. That is the faithfulness of God, because Xander is just an illustration that God's fulfilling his covenant to Abraham. And you need to remember that he does. When he saves people, that's an illustration that he's faithful to us. Second, he says, relay his faithfulness. Talk about it, verses 23 and following. He says, sing to the Lord. All the earth proclaim his good tidings of his salvation from day to day. Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among all the prophets. These are all imperatives. If you read them in Hebrew, they're all imperatives, which means they are not a what? They're not a suggestion. They are a command. So you're sitting there going, okay, I see the command to sing. Have you heard me? Yeah. Now, if I were to ask you, how many of you think you have a great voice and your hand went up, we need to have a sermon on pride or something, but Some can sing very well. It is not my thing. I play the piano. I don't sing. If I'm playing something on, you know, Journey or something on the piano, wife wants to talk to me, I'm like, honey, I'm either playing faithfully or we're talking. I can't play and sing to you at the same time. I mean, I have limitations. But he says, you need to sing to who? To the Lord. Okay, so I have some personal questions for you. Regardless of whether you're on key, off key, do you sing to God? Okay, I figured the first couple rows would. Okay. Do you sing to God in private? You and him, tune on your head, and you sing it to him. When I was a young gardener back in 1980, working for a landscape company, they assigned this huge company to me as one of my commercial accounts. It was called Sumitan Wire Corporation. And I had a hula hoe, and I hula hoed acres of weeds around all the little ground cover that they planted there. And I showed up there once a week to do it. And many times I was out there in the California sunshine, hula hoeing all the weeds. Means I'm digging all the dirt up by pulling it back, cutting the dirt to cut all the weeds. It helps your forearms as you're working. Many times I sang this song. I come to the garden alone while the dew's still on the roses. You know the rest of the song? And the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses. I love the next part. He walks with me. He talks with me and he tells me what? You're his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there at Sumitan Wire Corporation, no one's ever known. Because I could get back in my work truck, and I just had a moment with the Lord. Yeah. Now, he never, ever came down from heaven and said, now, Marty, that doesn't count. It's off key. Okay? Do you sing to the Lord? Yes. He tells you to do that. I think we sang Jesus Paid It All this morning, did we not?
Yes.
Perfect song to sing as a new Christian baptized. Because what do you realize? What did Xander realize? Jesus paid it all. My works mean nothing to God. False religions have a lot of works in them, and they make great people that do moral works, but you still got a sin problem. And Jesus solves the sin problem. Great, he paid it all. You can't work your way into heaven. You know, as I thought over the last 50 years, over the last several months, one of my favorite songs that keeps coming back to my mind, Great is Thy Faithfulness. Yeah. Oh God, my Father, there's no shadow of turning in thee. Thou changest not, thy compassions, they fail not. As thou hast been, that forever will be. Great is thy faithfulness. He says it twice. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed. What does it say? Your hand has provided. When I was a young married man with no money, making $4 an hour, thinking, wow, we're rolling in money now. You know, we really didn't have much to live on. God blessed us. And as I'm older and I look back at my life, it's a testimony to the faithfulness of God. When I look back at this church, it's the testimony of the faithfulness of God. He's always provided us what we need at the right time to make sure that we move forward as a church. He commands us to sing. So as you walk out here this morning, you should be thinking, if you're wondering what you should be doing, you should be thanking God by remembering what he's done and then relaying that to him, singing to him. He also commands us to proclaim the good tidings of his salvation from day to day. Proclaim the good tidings of his salvation. What does that mean? I should be talking about the fact he saved me. You know, I think your thankfulness and joy in walking with Christ can be measured by how much you, number one, sing to him, and how much you personally tell other people about him. You want to talk about a great apologetic, and the word apology in Greek, apologia, means to defend. You're defending the position of who Jesus is. How do I know he's the Messiah? Here, let me give you the reasons. But one of the great reasons I know he's the Messiah is my changed life. How do you argue with a changed life like a Xander? How do you argue with that? It's hard to, because it's a supernatural thing. You know, you can submit it to you to read Acts chapter 26, Paul's defense before Herod Agrippa, Bernice, and Festus, the Roman governor. He's on trial. And wow. He shares his entire testimony. When I go to Israel and we stand on day one at the Herod's amphitheater looking at the ocean waves crashing on the beach of the Mediterranean, and you stand at the apex of that giant 5,000-seat amphitheater, you stand on the stone of the accused where Paul would have stood, and you look up and you can see the seating where Felix and Agrippa would have been. And that's our first day in Israel, to stand there and give testimony of the courage of Paul to stand there and give testimony that Christ saved me. And then he tells them they need to repent too. Yeah. Unbelievable. When is the last time you had that kind of courage? And he says, hey, recall what God has done, relay it to other people. Get them excited about walking with God. And lastly, I close with this. He says, you need to roll up your sleeves, which is just a colloquial saying, really telling you, you need to get to work. Notice, as he's done with the song, we didn't cover every word of the song because we only have 30 minutes. How does he close? I'll just read it to you and then I'll make a couple comments. Number one, he says, so he left Asaph and his relatives there before the Ark of the Covenant after the song to minister before the Ark continually as every day's work required. Work required. And Obed-Edom and his 68 relatives, Obed-Edom, also the son of Jeduthun and Hosha, I wish they had normal names. They were the gatekeepers. And he left Zadok, the priest, and his relatives as priests before the tabernacle of the Lord in the high place, which is at Gibeon. Because remember, they're in transition of getting everything to Jerusalem. So they're still worshiping in Gibeon too. To offer burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar of the burnt offering continually, morning and evening, even according to all that is written in the law of the Lord, which he commanded Israel. And with them were, there was a man named Heman, Jeduthun, and the rest who were chosen. They were designated by name to give thanks to the Lord because of his loving kindness. And Jeduthun with trumpets and with cymbals, and for those who should sound aloud, and with instruments for songs of the Lord and songs of Jeduthun and for the gate. What in the world was he saying there? He's saying, if you're going to give thanks to God, you recall what he's done for you, you relay that to other people, and then you get to work serving your God who's faithful. Some of these guys had amazing jobs, like the priest, Zadok. I mean, they're offering sacrifices to cover the sins of people. I mean, they have a very important job. It says in here that some of them were there to play instruments. Yeah, I've studied cymbals for 10 years at the university. I play cymbals. Great. You can be on the team. Some of them played harps. Some of them played trumpets, etc. Everybody was plugged in to do something. Tells you a couple of times in here, some of them were gatekeepers. They stood at the gates to greet the people coming in. Do we have those in our church? Yes. Yeah, we do. We have men and women who are gatekeepers. We even have some teenagers that are gatekeepers. So that when worshipers are coming into church, they don't just have to open the door for themselves. How unchristian. The door is opened by somebody who greets you with a handshake, nice smile. Things are going great. Welcome to worship. You no sooner get in, other people are greeting you. Then you come into one of the worship shoots, and you might be an introvert or something, but someone's going to talk to you. And you're trying to come in, and it's like there's somebody greeting you coming into worship. Are they important? Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. They're straight out of 1 Corinthians 16. See, they're all important, whether it's the priest doing what a priest does or what I do, delivering the word, or somebody that's the door greeter, or somebody teaching in the children's department, whatever it is, leading a life group or leading a high school group, wherever it is, they are praising God and thanking God for being faithful. My question is, if you're not serving, you're probably sinning. Not to preach, sorry, but it's true. Because you're gifted by the Lord Almighty at the moment of conversion to use your gifts to glorify him. Greatest thing you can do is say, God, I want to thank you for being faithful to me, and where can you use me? And if you want to get used, you just call the church number and say, hey, I heard the sermon yesterday. I need to get plugged in. You will be amazed at how fast God will move in your life. Took 445 years to get the Ark to Jerusalem. Imagine how happy the day was as they celebrated the thankfulness of God. Main idea of the passage, in case you're lost in all the details, I present it to you this way. Thanksgiving for God's faithfulness involves what? Recalling, relaying, and rolling up your sleeves. God, I'm getting with the program because I'm thankful. How about you? Let's stand and worship God and thank him for his thankfulness, and may his blessings rest upon you. Amen. Amen.